Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two reports about science. Most of us rarely think about the Earth's magnetic field. We might know that it helps guide birds as they travel and keeps our compasses pointing north. But the magnetic field is much more. It is one of the main components that make life on the planet possible. However, the processes in the Earth's core that create the magnetic field are poorly understood. Now, scientists at the University of Maryland are working to reproduce the conditions that lie 3,000 kilometers below our feet. Deep inside Earth is a 3,400-kilometer-wide ball of liquid metals, iron and nickel. In the center is a smaller ball of solid iron. They combine to form what is called Earth's core. The core creates the electric currents responsible for Earth's magnetic field. The most immediate benefit is its part in navigation. Daniel Lathrop is a physics professor at the University of Maryland. He runs the laboratory where Earth's magnetic field is studied.
And the Earth's main magnetic field is a very important part of what makes the Earth a habitable planet, because it shields us from a lot of the worst parts of radiation from the sun.
Evidence shows that the Earth's magnetic field is not fixed in place. The strength of the field changes direction.
What we do know is the Earth's magnetic field has reversed north-south hundreds of times in Earth's history. And so the spin of the Earth stays the same, but where the magnetic pole is moves and has actually reversed.
Mr. Lathrop and his team are trying to find out how and why that happens. The researchers built a 3-meter-wide steel ball that turns. The ball is filled with 12.5 tons of sodium to reproduce the Earth's outer core. Sodium is a soft metal that melts at just under 100 degrees Celsius. A 1-meter-wide inner non-magnetic steel ball is used to represent Earth's solid iron core. Both can be turned independently. But turning them slowly has not created a process known as the dynamo effect. The dynamo effect is thought to be responsible for creating magnetic fields.
We only see magnetic fields when we impose small magnetic fields from the outside, although we see that imposing small magnetic fields from the outside, we get a factor of 10 larger magnetic fields induced by the flow. So we have a very effective at half-speed gain of magnetic fields without having what we call a dynamo, which is something that just starts on its own and grows a full size. So now we're aiming then to go to full speed.
Mr. Lathrop says it is difficult to predict changes that happen over thousands of years.
1 second of operation of the experiment models 5,000 years of evolution of the magnetic field. So the goal is to take data from the experiment to do mock predictions, and then you can improve the predictions.
Mr. Lathrop notes that the strength of Earth's magnetic field has dropped about 10% in the last 170 years. This means the reversal process may have already started, but the change is too slow to affect our everyday lives. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. The African rhinoceros is an endangered species. One kind, the northern white rhino, is very close to extinction. After the recent death of a female, only 4 northern white rhinos are still alive. Now, scientists are trying to find a way to save them and increase their numbers. Marcia James has more.
The biggest threat to rhinos are poachers who kill them for their horns. Some people in Vietnam and China believe that pills made of ground rhino horn can cure diseases and disorders, although no scientific evidence proves this. Since 2008, poachers in South Africa have killed almost 3,000 rhinos. The International Union for Conservation of Nature warns that they may become extinct before 2026. The northern white rhinoceros, which is actually gray, is extinct in the wild. The 4 remaining rhinos left are held in captivity, 3 females and 1 male called Sudan. Zachariah Mutahi takes care of the male rhino.
If we lost him, it will be a very big loss for the endangered species.
The Old Pujeta Conservancy is a wildlife sanctuary in Kenya. The northern white rhinos live there. With so few northern white rhinos remaining, attempts were made for a southern male rhino to mate with the female rhinos in the hope of producing babies. Scientists believed this would at least preserve some of the northern white rhino genes, but this was not successful. Scientists now are trying to fertilize northern white rhino eggs in a laboratory and implant them in southern white rhino females. Richard Vine is head of the Old Pujeta Conservancy.
The initial approach will be to look at in vitro fertilization, removal of eggs from females, three remaining females, and mixing those eggs with sperm, which is stored from northern white rhinos across the world, to create an embryo which would then be implanted into a surrogate white rhino female to create a purebred northern white rhino calf.
While scientists are trying to get the white rhinos to produce offspring, others are trying to take away the reason that poachers hunt the animals. 2 U.S.-based scientists say they are using the latest biotechnology techniques to create artificial rhino horn. The substance not only looks and feels like the real thing, it also contains the same proteins. Matthew Marcus is head of Pembient, a biotech company.
We're not bioidentical yet, though that's the goal.
Matthew Marcus hopes that poachers will find it less costly and safer to resell the lab-grown horns to their Asian buyers. The lab-grown horns will look real. No matter how they test the substance, people will not be able to see the difference. Researchers say flooding the market with artificial horns may keep the real animals with the real horns safe from poachers. I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. Billionaire businessman Donald Trump wants to stop automatically giving U.S. citizenship to anyone who is born in the United States. Mr. Trump is the leading Republican presidential candidate. He says automatic citizenship is the reason many women come to the United States illegally and give birth. He wants to cancel the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens. In 5 months, voters in some states will begin choosing the Republican Party's presidential nominee. All of the 17 Republican candidates have called for strong measures to stop people from entering the country illegally, especially from Mexico. But not all of them support ending automatic citizenship for people born in the United States. Public opinion surveys show former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and U.S. Senator Marco Rubio are two of the strongest Republican presidential candidates. Neither man agrees with Mr. Trump. Mr. Bush says people born in the U.S. have what he calls a constitutionally protected right to become American citizens. Senator Rubio said he would support measures to stop women from coming to the United States illegally to give birth to children so their babies will automatically be citizens. But he says he does not support canceling the 14th Amendment. Other Republican candidates say they support Mr. Trump's call for its cancellation. The Center for Immigration Studies seeks to limit immigration to the United States. It says 30 of the world's 194 countries give citizenship to people born in their country. But it says the United States and Canada are the only two developed countries that do so. In 2010, the Pew Hispanic Center estimated that 8% of the 4.3 million babies born in the U.S. in 2008 were the children of people who had entered the country illegally. Automatic citizenship for those born in the United States has been part of the country's laws since the colonies declared their independence from England in the late 1700s. The new country's laws were based on English common law. But in 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the children of slaves were not American citizens. The Constitution was amended after the Civil War in the 1860s. Anti-slavery northern states defeated pro-slavery southern states in the war. The Constitution was changed to make it clear that all black Americans and freed slaves were U.S. citizens. Conservative lawmakers in the United States have sometimes tried to end automatic citizenship, but they have never received much support. Changing the U.S. Constitution is difficult. At least two-thirds of the House and Senate must support any change. If that happens, the proposed change is sent to the states, where at least 38 of the 50 state legislatures must support it before it can become part of the Constitution. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And now, the weekly special English program of American Stories. Our story today is called The Return of a Private. It was written by Hamlin Garland. Here is Harry Monroe with our story.
The soldiers cheered as the train crossed the border into the state of Wisconsin. It had been a long trip from the south back to their homes in the north. One of the men had a large red scar across his forehead. Another had an injured leg that made it painful for him to walk. The third had unnaturally large and bright eyes because he had been sick with malaria. The three soldiers spread their blankets on the train seats and tried to sleep. It was a cold evening, even though it was summertime. Private Smith, the soldier with the fever, shivered in the night air. His joy in coming home was mixed with fear and worry. He knew he was sick and weak. How could he take care of his family? Where would he find the strength to do the heavy work all farmers have to do? He had given 3 years of his life to his country, and now he had very little money and strength left for his family. Morning came slowly with a pale yellow light. The train was slowing down as it came into the town of La Crosse, where the three soldiers would get off the train. The station was empty because it was Sunday. "I'll get home in time for dinner," Smith thought. She usually has dinner about 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And he smiled. Smith and the other two soldiers jumped off the train together. "Well, boys," Smith began, "here's where we say goodbye. We've marched together for many miles. Now I suppose we are done." The three men found it hard to look at each other. "We ought to go home with you," one of the soldiers said to Smith. "You'll never be able to walk all those miles with that heavy pack on your back." "Oh, I'm all right," Smith said, putting on his army cap. "Every step takes me closer to home." They all shook hands. "Goodbye. Good luck. Same to you. Goodbye." Smith turned and walked away quickly. After a few minutes, he turned again and waved his cap. His two friends did the same. Then they marched away with their long, steady soldier's step. Smith walked for a while, thinking of his friends. He remembered the many days they had been together during the war. He thought of his friend Billy Tripp, too. Poor Billy. A bullet came out of the sky one day and tore a great hole in Billy's chest. Smith knew he would have to tell the sad story to Billy's mother and young wife. But there was little to tell. The sound of a bullet cutting through the air, Billy crying out, then falling with his face in the dirt. The fighting he had done since then had not made him forget the horror of that moment when Billy died. Soon the fields and houses became familiar. Smith knew he was close to home. The sun was burning hot as he began climbing the last hill. Finally, he reached the top and looked down at his farm in the beautiful valley. He was almost home. Mrs. Smith was alone on the farm with her three children. Mary was 9 years old, Tommy was 6, and little Teddy had just turned 4. Mrs. Smith had been dreaming about her husband when the chickens awakened her that Sunday morning. She got out of bed, got dressed, and went out to feed the chickens. Then she saw the broken fence near the chicken house. She had tried to fix it again and again. Mrs. Smith sat down and cried. The farmer, who had promised to take care of the farm while her husband was away, had been lazy and dishonest. The first year, he shared the wheat with Mrs. Smith. But the next year, he took almost all of it for himself. She had sent him away. Now the fields were full of wheat, but there was no man on the farm to cut it down and sell it. 6 weeks before, her husband told her in a letter that he would be coming home soon. Other soldiers were returning home, but her husband had not come. Every day she watched the road leading down the hill. This Sunday morning she could no longer stand being alone. She jumped up, ran into the house, and quickly dressed the children. She carefully locked the door and started walking down the road to the farmhouse of her neighbor, Mrs. Gray. Mary Gray was a widow with a large family of strong sons and pretty daughters. She was poor, but she never said no to a hungry person who came to her farm and asked for food. She worked hard, laughed often, and was always in a cheerful mood. When she saw Mrs. Smith and the children coming down the road, Mrs. Gray went out to meet them. "Please come right in, Mrs. Smith. We were just getting ready to have dinner." Mrs. Smith went into the noisy house. Mrs. Gray's children were laughing and talking all at the same time. Soon she was laughing and singing with the rest of them. The long table in the kitchen was piled with food. There were potatoes, fresh corn, apple pies, hot bread, sweet pickles, bread and butter, and honey. They all ate until they could eat no more. Then the men and children left the table. The women stayed to drink their tea. "Mama," said one of Mrs. Gray's daughters, "please read our fortunes in the tea leaves. Tell us about our futures." Mrs. Gray picked up her daughter's cup and stirred it first to the left, then to the right. Then she looked into it with a serious expression. "I see a handsome man with a red beard in your future," she said. Her daughter screamed with laughter. Mrs. Smith trembled with excitement when it was her turn. "Somebody is coming home to you," Mrs. Gray said slowly. "He's carrying a rifle on his back, and he's almost there." Mrs. Smith felt as if she could hardly breathe. "And there he is," Mrs. Gray cried, pointing to the road. They all rushed to the door to look. A man in a blue coat, with a gun on his back, was walking down the road toward the Smith farm. His face was hidden by a large pack on his back. Laughing and crying, Mrs. Smith grabbed her hat and her children and ran out of the house. She hurried down the road after him, calling his name and pulling her children along with her. But the soldier was too far away for her voice to reach him. When she got back to their farm, she saw the man standing by the fence. He was looking at the little house and the field of yellow wheat. The sun was almost touching the hills in the west. The cowbells rang softly as the animals moved toward the barn. How peaceful it all is, Private Smith thought. How far away from the battles, the hospitals, the wounded, and the dead. My little farm in Wisconsin. How could I have left it for those years of killing and suffering? Trembling and weak with emotion, Mrs. Smith hurried up to her husband. Her feet made no sound on the grass. But he turned suddenly to face her. For the rest of his life, he would never forget her face at that moment. "Emma," he cried. The children stood back, watching their mother kissing this strange man. He saw them, and kneeling down, he pulled from his pack three huge red apples. In a moment, all three children were in their father's arms. Together, the family entered the little, unpainted farmhouse. Later that evening, after supper, Smith and his wife went outside. The moon was bright above the eastern hills. Sweet, peaceful stars filled the sky as the night birds sang softly and tiny insects buzzed in the soft air. His farm needed work. His children needed clothing. He was no longer young and strong, but he began to plan for next year. With the same courage he had faced the war, Private Smith faced his difficult future.
You have just heard the story, The Return of a Private. It was written by Hamlin Garland and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your narrator was Harry Monroe. The Voice of America invites you to listen again next week at this same time to another American story. This is Susan Clark.